Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com. 111-110.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and today I'm going to be a great guest. We're really excited and complimented that he's going to be here with us today. None other than the legendary American iconic Sheriff of Milwaukee, Sheriff David Clark. Sheriff, can't thank you enough for being here this afternoon. I'm sure you did a bunch of stuff, but thank you so much on behalf of everybody in the law enforcement community for showing up.
Pleasure to be on with you. I don't know how legendary I am, but I appreciate that introduction. I like to think of myself as just a guy who believes in God, believes in his country, and still fighting the good fight to defend freedom and to defend the service, the sacrifice, the heroism of the law enforcement community.
I think that nowadays, courage defines a hero. And when you even just open your mouth and adamantly express what you believe is right, and we all know that it is, that's why when I say legendary, there are people who tuck their tails between their legs and will not speak up for what they actually feel on the inside, when you're certainly not one of those people.
You know, I have a platform now, and I want to use that platform, like I said, in furtherance of freedom and liberty throughout the United States, in defense of the men and women who put on the uniform of their community to go out and protect and to serve. And I realize it puts a target on my back, but there's been a target on my back for the last 20 years. But that's okay, because, you know, part of leadership is making a sacrifice and reminding yourself that it's not about you, it's about what you can do for others. And so the fact that I take these things on, sometimes at peril, no doubt about it, but what a wasted opportunity if I sat here with this platform, just kept my head down and just started, you know, always thought about, you know, how it's going to affect or how it's going to hurt me. It's not about me.
I couldn't agree more. I think one thing that people don't realize, that when you're in a position to try and promote good change, I don't want to use the word progressive because that defines something else these days. It takes a real hero and a real legend to not ignore the gift that God gave you. And I'm sure he told you in some sense that, hey, I chose you. You can do this. You can have impact. Do you ever feel that way?
Every day. From the time that I became a law enforcement officer 40 years ago and all the way through the time that I was the elected sheriff of Milwaukee County, elected four times. But, you know, I have a deep faith in God. And, you know, God will lead the way. He'll point the way. And now in this new role, being retired, like I said, I'm a foot soldier now for freedom and liberty throughout the United States. I believe that this is the position God wants me in. You know, I get talked into often about running for another office. Hey, we need you. Why don't you run for governor? Why don't you run for U.S. Senate? Why don't you run for Congress, mayor, whatever? But, you know, that'd be making it about me. It's not about a title per se. I mean, look what I've been able to do with the title of sheriff, for heaven's sakes, a local sheriff that, you know, took on a national profile, mainly because of some of the issues that I would take on that a lot of people in my position in law enforcement, executive position, they wouldn't dare touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Why do you think some leaders are apprehensive to touch it with a 10-foot pole?
Lack of courage. Again, they're looking about their own survival, and I get it. When I took these things on as the elected sheriff of Milwaukee County, I had a mortgage to pay. You know, I had car payments. I wanted to put food on the table. I had other people that were counting on me to bring home the bacon, so to speak. But, you know, all you have to do is trust in God, and you have to be smart. There's no doubt about it, because this environment is brought with peril. So you got to be smart. You can't just talk off the top of your head. You can't just blurt out something on social media without thinking ahead of time. You know, I've put out over 13,000, 14,000 tweets. You know, I've never had to delete one. You know why? because I think about what I'm about to do and what I'm about to say before I send it off. And I put it through a litmus test. You know, does this sound good? Can someone twist this? Does it sound clumsy? Is this the right moment to say this? Maybe next week, let it develop a little more. You know, the issue, if there's an issue of the day, I think ahead of time, and that's an important aspect of leadership because there is so much at stake and people are counting on you and people are watching you. And I want people to look at me and go, you know what? I might not agree with what that guy said, but in listening to him, he thought that through and he walked me through it. I still don't agree with it, but I can tell that he gave that deep thought. That's what's important to me, not to get people to agree with me. Just understand where I'm coming from, like I try to do to the other side.
Tell me about your earlier childhood of when you started to recognize or realize that you wanted to serve as a law enforcement officer. What was your upbringing like? At what point did you start to sway towards the way of law enforcement? Give me the details on that as an early child.
Yeah, it really didn't happen in my early childhood. And I talk about this in my book, Cop Under Fire. If people are interested, it'll give you the deep dive into some of the things that we're going to talk about today that we don't have, you know, forever to talk about. But that's why I think the book is a good read, Cop Under Fire. You know, I was blessed to be the product of a two-parent family. My mom and dad were lower middle class. They just worked hard. My dad worked at the United States Post Office after he got out of the Army. My mom worked in the Milwaukee public school system. They had five kids. They did everything they could to raise their kids and give them a better opportunity, more opportunities than they have. And I think that's what every parent's goal is. They want their kids to, you know, you can't really like steer and predict how they're going to turn out. But if you at least develop them and give them the foundation, they'll find their own way. And so, you know, my dad was real big on discipline. When my dad gave me an order like, for instance, when I get home, the garage better be clean. I had to say, yes, sir. Clear, sir. You know, so that he knew that I understood what he was talking about. You know, I didn't like that stuff at the time, but now I know what he was trying to do. Teaching me respect for authority, teaching me respect in general and discipline. And so he and my mom instilled those virtues in me, like patriotism. 4th of July was a big deal in my house. We went to the local park. We walked down to the local park. We got a little flag. And, you know, we walked in the 4th of July parade. It's just a neighborhood one, right? And then you went to the park and you got ice cream. And then at the end of the day, we, you know, cooked hot dogs and had a little cookout in the backyard. And then we watched the fireworks at night. But that was important to us. And it was important to my mom and dad. Patriotism, things like respect, things like accepting responsibility for your actions. You know, those are all things that they instilled in me and they demanded a lot of me. So I think that early childhood experience, you know, probably led me later on. It wasn't until I was about 18, 19 years old that I started thinking about becoming a law enforcement officer. It was only because my dad had suggested it. He didn't, you know, push me in that direction, but he said, you know, give that some thought going into policing. You know, I never did. But then as time went on, I'm looking for a career. I had a job. You know, I wasn't looking for a job, but I wanted a career. And, you know, that my dad had mentioned that, you know, led me to at least pursue that. And, you know, it worked out. I had a few bumps in the road early on in my career, adjusting to a law enforcement environment, a very heavy command and control. I mean, my dad was that way, but for heaven's sakes, my dad loved me. My bosses at work didn't love me, but that's the way law enforcement agencies were run. And once I accepted that, then my career took off. You know, I got promoted 3 or 4 times in the Milwaukee Police Department. And of course, I got elected sheriff. So, but I think those early childhood experience gave me that foundation, especially to thrive in a law enforcement environment, for heaven's sakes, very steep in command and control.
On a quick side note, I will have you know that I throw one of the most profound 4th of July parties every year. So much so that my wife had asked me, what is your hang up with the 4th of July? And I said, you know, it's those moments in my childhood that every 4th of July seemed to be just so much fun. It was just such a patriotic day to remember of what we're thankful for. And you know, I'm not going to lie. The fireworks too. I'm a little bit of a nut with fireworks. I like them. I don't know what. It's just when I was a kid, I was It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. Do you have kids?
I have no kids.
Okay. If you had had kids, how do you think you would have instilled, especially being somebody who is a sheriff and for many years and certainly a public figure, what's your advice to somebody in this next generation of children that we're raising to make sure that they show up as a law-abiding, productive citizen of the United States? And what should they remember about that?
It'd be easy for me to say, you know, not having had kids, but, you know, I have nieces and nephews, and I was a kid myself. So I can speak from that standpoint. And a sense of discipline, instilling virtues into kids, instill some virtues into them, for heaven's sakes. You know, don't try to be their friend. Be a parent. Set an example. Be the example. You know, for the most part, let's be honest, it takes two parents to you know, who work together in the development of their children. I know it doesn't always work out that way, but you look today, where they say 70% of Black kids growing up in America are in single parent households. That makes it difficult. It really does. So, you know, do what you can, but make it about your kids. It's not about you anymore once you start having kids. And I don't even have kids, but that's what I looked at. That's the way I looked at it. We talked about it earlier in my profession. I said, this is not about me anymore. It's about others. And so I would, my advice to parents, because I've seen it too. That's another thing that qualifies me to talk about this, not having kids. I've seen the effects of poor and ineffective parenting, for heaven's sakes. And it's devastating. So, you know, I speak from that perch. And I think it, like I said, it qualifies me to talk about the type of values and the type of qualities to be an effective parent. Because once you start having kids, that is your most important job. The most important job is the development of your and the raising of your children. Let me go back, give you a story. Yeah. I was the sheriff at the time, and I'm walking down the street, and a guy stopped me. It's a Black guy. And he looked and he knew who I was. I was very well known in my community because I was out in the community. Mm-hmm. And the guy looked over and he said, "Hey, you're Sheriff Clark." I said, "Yes, sir." You know, I said to him, "Sir." I said, "Yes, sir." That's the way I talk to people. And he said, "You know, I'm out here. I'm looking for a job. I just got out of prison. And nobody wants to hire me because, you know, of my past." And he goes, "You know, I'm trying to change and trying to make a difference." And he said, "But, you know, I just can't find a job." First question I asked, "Do you have any kids?" He says, "Yeah, I got three of them." I said, "There's your job right there. Your job, your first job now, is to make sure that your kids don't end up in the predicament that you're in right now. And as for finding work," I said, "just grind. You're going to have to grind it out. You set the table." Remember we talked about accepting responsibility for your actions? I said, "It's going to be tough. It's not impossible, but it's going to be tough for you to crawl out of this hole, but it's doable if you're willing to persevere." I said, "But go home and be a good father." And you know what he said to me? He said, "I never thought about that. Thanks, no. Sheriff." That's a true story.
There's a saying that I love, and it's from Mother Teresa. It said, "If you want to do something great for the world, go home and love your family."
Yeah,
and when you start to unpack that, what it means is you're setting forth the next generation of greatness, teaching your kids to be those who care about the family and love one another and love other people. You know, I constantly instilling in my children good morals and principles of, you know, making sure that you're standing up for people. I was just telling a story before. We went to Yankee Stadium last night for my son's, one of my kids' fifth birthday. And every time we saw a cop, I said, "Go up to that guy and tell him thank you." And my kids walk up to these guys. And sometimes it catches them a little off guard. They don't know what to do. It's a little uncomfortable. I said, "Just tell these guys thank you." Well, every time you see them, just tell them thank you. And I want you to understand what they're doing and why. I tell these kids, you know, still a little young to comprehend. I said, you know, these guys and girls are here uncomfortable in this heat at this stadium so we can enjoy it. Yeah, they're making a little money off duty and all that stuff. But this isn't a glorious position to be in, believe me. And I want you guys to appreciate them. Right. Yeah. But I just want my kids to have an appreciation for other human beings.
Good for you.
Try to
serve a lot. Good for you.
I've kind of found myself as a older man in the past 7 to 8 years of my life and am very happy with what I've actually found about who I am and what my heart and soul actually means. Which leads me down to this next question. which is, what did you or do love the most about law enforcement and your continued commitment to the men and women in blue? What's your why? And what do you love the most about this profession?
Well, the important role that it plays. I mean, for heaven's sakes, if you're not safe, nothing else matters. And we're seeing that play out today, more so with this surge in violent street crime all across America. We play an important role in society. And like I said, it's about what you're doing for others. It's public service. We're public servants. And I always remind elected officials that like to say that, you know, well, you know, I'm in public service. I go, no, you're in political service. And it's not to diminish it. I go, there's a difference between political service and public service. And, you know, most people, especially in this great country that we live in now, they understand the importance of law and order. I mean, for the survival of communities, for the survival of cities, for the survival of states, you have to have your arms around the political leaders, their arms around public safety. It's the most important role. And it's why they get funded the most. You know, a lot of times mayors and people on town councils, city councils and county councils will complain that the public safety budget is the largest budget in local government. It's supposed to be, because it's the first priority of every local government is to secure the personal safety of citizens. So I remind them of that. You know, when I was going back every year looking for more money because it became more expensive to protect the community. So I think it's that role that I got to play. And then people recognize, you know, the respect they have for law enforcement officers, at least in most communities still. And that was what was important to me.
There are some times that we come under fire for promoting proactive police work in a time where some people think the cops shouldn't be getting involved at all. And I'm very eager to go onto a public platform, or probably some more thoughtful people than myself. I have some people who work at this company as instructors who are uncanny in their intelligence, and I would bring them with me to any verbal battle. But I can't help but think about proactive policing and going out and stopping crime before crime occurs. And often at times, these people who are agenda driven will say that, well, pretextual stops are a racist thing. They target a certain people of color. And we've actually shown in many dialogues, even when they've been invited into the program, here's a different perspective of what we're actually looking for when cops are trained properly. And actually, here's the results of what cops are training are getting out of this training seminar. And I'll just give you one quick story, this Reader's Digest version of it, if I can. We had a police officer who took one of our training courses called Interdiction Mastermind, and he forewent writing tickets and happened to interrupt an active kidnapping where a 9 and a 12-year-old were being transported across state lines to be sold on the black market. They were actually kidnapped. And they said, you know, once we saw the blue lights come on, we knew that we were going to go home. We were going to be saved. The question is what would have happened had that police officer not given a different perspective of, and he said, look, I laid the ticket book down. I stopped worrying about the tickets. I started opening my eyes and looking for things like this. Even one step further than that, what people aren't realizing is, especially with today, I'm not taking the opportunity of today's current climate or current events to push my agenda. I never do it. I stay away from it. But if you don't think for a second that the next mass shooter of some of these significant atrocities isn't going to have some kind of reaction or give some signals to the police while en route to commit these crimes.
Red flag. Yeah. System blinking red. I know what you're getting at. Preventive patrols you're talking about. Look, I understand this delicate balance here, and that's what it is. And that's what I would hope that the men and women I send out every day in terms of using their judgment, you know, you try to find balance. You have to enforce the law. For instance, you want the roads to be safe, so you enforce traffic violations for that reason. What I reminded them, and I used to get into battles with the county board about this when they were talking about how citation revenue was down. I said, that's not our purpose. Our purpose is to protect the community. Sometimes that means we will give out citations in the activity of making streets safer, so on and so forth. I said, but that's not the goal. And I bristled all the time, and I still do, about these communities that use the police, misuse the police just for revenue. It angers the public. Nobody likes getting tickets. That's why I said you got to strike a balance, for heaven's sakes. But some of the things that we've seen go on, you know, some excellent police work has been off the basis of a traffic stop. Look, the fact is that in these high crime areas, and this is why, and this is what I get to say, because I'm black myself, when people say, well, how come, you know, blacks get a disproportionate number of traffic violations and disproportionate amount of arrests and so on and so forth? Well, they're in high crime areas, and that's where most of the policing is. If they weren't high crime area, the police wouldn't get there. That means fewer tickets, fewer arrests, but the police have to be there. So, you know, a traffic stop can yield a treasure trove of public safety. You're going to find people wanted on serious felony warrants. You're going to find guns in the hands of prohibited persons. You're going to find drugs, like the example you gave, you know, kidnap victims, off of a simple traffic stop. So what I would say in the discussions I have, if people are hung up, because we derive, keep in mind, we derive our authority from the consent of the governed, all right? We don't make the laws, we enforce them. And so what I remind some of these people, you know, that in these discussions I have, is we can change the law. You don't want cars stopped for not having registration plates? Fine, get rid of registration, change the law. If you don't want cars stopped for, you know, like having burnout taillights or headlights on, and I understand, and that can be picayune-ish, but the fact is it's on the books. And if we have a real problem with it, don't tell cops to ignore the law. Change the damn law. Take it off the books. Parking regulations, parking violations. You'd have mass chaos, though, if you don't. And but, you know, the cops. And I remind cops as I get to talk to them all across the country to this day, you know, find balance in this stuff. You know, when I started in policing, keep in mind that you adjusted on the numbers, amount of tickets you gave out, amount of arrests you made. That's how you were judged, not the stuff that you resolved without giving a ticket out. Maybe there's a better way. You weren't judged on that because they can't see that, right? They could say, hey, right, you only got 20 parking tickets last month, and a month before you had 38. What happened? You know, well, you know, and fortunately, law enforcement agencies have gotten away from that because it's been deemed illegal to have quotas, so to speak. But I came up in that era, so I understand it. And the important thing is find a balance between keeping the public safe and enforcing the law. And sometimes that means you're going to have to arrest people and give out citations, so on and so forth.
And I think you said it perfectly before. You know, I'm not sitting here knocking the significance of all realms of law enforcement divisions. There's a time and place for everything to be well balanced. And, you know, I often say things like, have you forgot what your mission and purpose is? If you're not a police, and I talk about the demonization of the word interdiction. And I'm a constitutionalist. I follow what the Constitution is. I will not. I had a guy recently call me over the weekend. He had a little bit of a Fourth Amendment issue. And I said, I know what you want me to tell you, but I'm not here to tell you things are going to be okay. Your search, although not intended to be malicious, was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. I know you didn't know. This is a training issue. Do I think that your agency is handling it well? No. The way they're treating you? No. You've been served a amount of training where you're set up to inevitably fail. You went to an academy that you swung a stick at a bag for 25 hours and yelled, get back. You'll never swing a stick at a bag in real life and scream, get back, while you hold a stick. So when we look at field training programs, you've been sitting in a car with a guy's got 28 years in patrol, been divorced 3 times, and show you how to take a job that takes 26 minutes and turn it to 4.5 hours, how to dodge the radio and get a half price egg sandwich. So when you show up on your own 12, 14, 18 weeks later and try to do something and do it incorrectly, and they ask you why you did it incorrectly, they should be asking themselves why you did it incorrectly. And that's kind of the position we've taken of, like, we've been serving these men and women up with situations ready to fail. And there's got to be some acknowledgement of, we've got to change. We've got to talk about humanity, compassion, the law, and what it actually says, what you can do, what you can't do. you know, a balance is right. And like you said, if they're so hung up on certain laws that the police should not be enforcing, they'll then change it. And they did. Marijuana, right? If you think that marijuana should be legal,
right,
and you make it legal, guess what? The cops are good with it. Every cop I know is like, I don't get it. It's legal now. And that's the rules. We will follow them accordingly. And in New Jersey, they actually said, our attorney general said, police can use marijuana off duty.
Wow. I don't know about that, but
yeah, I'm just saying, like, the point is we're not sitting here picking and choosing what we like about the law. We're sitting here enforcing what we're told and supposed to be enforcing. And then you're right. As you progress in your career, you begin to prioritize what's more important. And I think that comes with perspective changes of what's important and what's not. I think we all start the same way, right? You know, you started 40 years ago. I started 21. Turning a radar unit, doing what other cops are doing, writing tickets. That's what we think police work is because that's what we see other cops doing. And then sometimes a guy like Sheriff David Clark shows up and says, that's not exactly what we're meant to do. We're not here to be ticket generating machines nonstop. That's not what the public wants from their law enforcement officers.
Right. And this profession has progressed tremendously for the good, you know, over from the time that I started, which was the late 70s. And it's now about problem solving. Before, it used to be about tactics, strategies, defense and arrest tactics, which is still important today. There's no doubt about that. But there was a heavy emphasis on that sort of stuff. But we need cops to be problem solvers. And what do I mean by that? We need them to think, all right? Use the brain that you've been given and don't become this static, well, the policy says and the law says. You know, I mean, take it in conjunction with a number of other things that you're dealing with at that particular call or assignment to figure out the best way to get things done. Now, in some of these high crime areas, that is not going to be as useful or effective as it would in, let's say, a middle-class neighborhood, low crime, which is why you have a different style of policing in rural and suburban areas. It isn't that, and you don't have as many arrests and so on and so forth. It's not because those are better people, but it's a different type of policing that's required. For the most part, you have strong families, you have successful schools, you have parents that raise their kids. And so a lot of this stuff, they take care of it themselves. But in some of these dysfunctional communities, and that's where you see all of these things that are playing out today with law enforcement officers, with use of force, so on and so forth. It's in these high crime areas. That's nothing to do with the black people there, and the cops treat the black people different. It's a different type of policing. It's very dangerous for the law enforcement officer. You're dealing with dangerous people. You're not out there to have a back and forth conversation. You have to issue more orders, you know, get out of the road. Hey, do this, do that, put your hands behind your back, so on and so forth, because the environment is different. You know, anybody who's been in the military can tell you it's the same thing. You know, war zone's a little different than when you're back at the barracks or you're back at the, you know, you got an assignment and not the hot zones, but they call it, so to speak, you know, different type of soldiering. So, but we need to do a better job, I think, from the training aspect of teaching cops things like human behavior, why humans behave the way they do. It's a psychology, right? So as you go into it, understanding and, oh, yeah, okay, I see what's going on here. And it really isn't about the dog barking. It's these two neighbors don't get along and haven't gotten along for a long time. And so this neighbor found this dog barking as an opportunity to call the police. You figure things out. And then you can approach, you know, try some remedies, apply some remedies that might work for the long term, not just the dog barking, because you'll be back there again. You know, one thing that cops can tell you is we always seem to be back at the same houses, you know, in the same neighborhoods, you know, where the crime is, so on and so forth. And a lot of these things, the cop can't do anything about. A cop can't run somebody's household. You know, you get called to the house there. A cop. If you have poor public policy, if you have poor public policy decisions by the city, you can't do anything. That's not your fault. You can't do anything to alter that. So you go there, and what you do is you do the best that you can with what you've been given. and hope to, you know, at the very best, put a Band-Aid on it for now, because you're limited and cops have to realize when they're limited, and other people, supervisors, have to realize when the cops are limited. Public officials have to realize when the cops are limited to do anything about it. And the same with society. The residents of that community have to realize these aren't miracle workers, for heaven's sakes. These are police officers who have given a certain amount of resources and training, but they're not miracle workers. And in most circumstances, the cops, they just do the best they can, knowing, you know, I'll probably be back here again. But, you know, this is the way society has been set up right now. Everything is dumped into the lap of a police officer.
When you said something just recently, it says they're doing the best they can. I really believe that a far majority of police officers are doing that. Sometimes it doesn't look like they are. Sometimes they do it unintentionally, and it's not the right decision or right choice. But in my 21 years of this profession and being associated with it, I am hard pressed to find many names and faces in my mind of people that I worked with who showed up to work with ill intentions. Right. Sometimes things happen, mistakes happen, but it was never ill intentions. They showed up with the right mindset, whether it was the proper way to get to where they wanted to go with their goal. They always showed up with the right idea in mind. I want to help. I want to stop crime. I want to do this. And a good administration recognizes the men and women who are showing up for the purpose versus the men and women, some of them there, who needed a job. How do you feel your men and women that worked for you for all those years while you were the sheriff of Milwaukee, how do you feel they or think that they felt about you as their leader?
Good. And I don't say that because it's me, but they knew I cared and they knew I had their back. And that was important to them because, you know, these officers are thrust into an environment. It's a mess sometimes. It's chaotic. And this is an imperfect world. And that's why I mentioned before, cops are human, subject to the same imperfections of human that anybody else is. All right. Sometimes we make mistakes, honest mistakes. Sometimes we do dumb stuff, no doubt about it, but not with ill intent. But you do some dumb stuff. But human beings will do that from time to time. And so what I continually reminded my officers, and I demonstrated in a couple of incidents, high profile incidents, is that if you go out there and you use your training, use the resources we've given you, and you trust your judgment, and you make decisions that don't have the outcome that you thought you might have, and things go horribly wrong through no fault of your own, I'm going to have your back, because this is an imperfect world. And I did. And there are several occasions where I had to demonstrate that. Both of them were uses of force. And I stood by the officers because when I put everything together and got all the information, I said, hey, look, you know, here's the way I see it. And you've elected me to make these decisions and I'm making it this way. And I explained it. I walked it through. I explained it to the public. Everyone didn't always agree. But, you know, at least, like I said, you know, you walk them through it. And at least they'll know that your heart's in the right place. That's important to people. Just knowing that your heart is in the right place. And if you demonstrate that, and the same thing with my officers, as you know, the question you asked, they knew I had their back. That was important to them. And, you know, sometimes I had to smack them down. I had to hand out discipline. I had to hand out stiff discipline. And I had to terminate people that I thought were not a good fit for this type of work. I made those tough decisions. I wasn't trying to be their friend, you know, because I was elected by the public. And I used to remind my officers too. I go, you know what? I work for them. I don't work for you guys. Your union works for you. I work for them. However, I make decisions that impact on your life out on the street. And I have to take that I have to keep that in mind too. And that's, again, I keep coming back to this word balance. You try to find a balance. You don't always find it. And even if you do, it's not going to last long. You know, look at it like a scale or a teeter-totter back and forth. You try to find that equilibrium, and you might find it for a little bit, and then all of a sudden it's going to be like this. That's the constant that officers are going to have to deal with. But always be in search of the balance, and even if you don't find it, you'll get close. But if you don't consider the balance, you're going to go too far in one direction, and that's not going to be good.
The people of Milwaukee reelected you sheriff many, many times. Do you feel like the public appreciated you, and why?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. Again, I hear from all the time. And even to this day, when I'm out in public, you know, I've been retired for a couple of years now. And even to this day, people will come up and you know, I want to thank you for your service to this community. We miss you, so on and so forth. And that is gratifying. Okay. Because at the time, you don't know. Sure, at election time, you know, that's your, you know, that's the report card, right? And how you're doing. And, you know, in this elective representative democracy that we have, constitutional democracy, we get to pick our leaders. And the fact that they kept electing me over and over for the four times that I ran was a testament. That's how they showed me, is by reelecting me.
What do you think they liked the most about you?
Straightforward. They knew what they were going to get. They knew what they had. Like I said, everyone didn't agree. You know, I'm a very conservative, ideologically conservative guy, rule of law, constitution, law and order. And I live in a, and worked, I represented a very liberal county. Voters, very liberal. This is an uber lefty county, Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, county of about 1 million people. But they kept electing me because I think because they knew my heart was in the right place. You don't have to agree with everything. You know, a guy told me this, a confidant, not long after I got elected my first term. We're having breakfast one day, and he said, Clark, just remember this. Every time you make a decision, 50% of the people are going to hate you for it. That was profound, but it was very true. You know, you look at our elections now, they're closer, just around 50-50, you know, 51-49. 50. It's rarely, you know, 60-40 in any, and polling is the same way, right? Polls are the same way. They're pretty equal. And so I kept that to heart because it made me understand, just, David, do what, in your judgment, you think is the right thing to do, because 50% of people are going to hate you for it anyway. And even if I went the other way with it, let's say I made a decision, I'll just make something up. I can either pick blue or red, and I pick blue. Well, the other people who like red, they're going to hate me for it. But if I had to pick red, then the blue people are going to hate me for it. So that's what I mean by you can't get caught up in, when you're making these decisions like that, the ones that you have time for, they're not exigent. You can't get caught up in, you know, who won't be happy about this. Just know 50% of the people are not going to be happy. Use your best judgment. And I think people saw that in me, that I had their best interests at heart. And really, that's all we should expect. It's all we should expect out of people in these positions of leadership. It's their heart in the right place.
What do you think is a top quality, or maybe three top qualities, of a great leader?
One of the most important qualities is the ability to anticipate. It keeps you out ahead of things. See them coming. Okay, see things coming down the road. See around corners so that you can respond or have to counter, you know, whatever. That's when you have time to think about it. Once it's right in your face, it's a little too late. So I think the ability to anticipate, and then also the ability to create and manage change, because the world is constantly changing and you can be a part of the change. I know that sounds cliche-ish, but that's what I mean by create change. And then change creates chaos and confusion. And so you have to manage it. You have to manage the change. I think that's another important quality. And then trusting your judgment, I think, would be the third one. Just believe in yourself.
What is one of the best training courses you've ever been to as a police officer?
Probably I went to an interrogation school because I was in the detective bureau for many years. It was my first promotion to detective out of uniform patrol. And I worked in homicide, violent crimes, property crimes. And so I got to, you know, chance to interview witnesses. You're always interviewing somebody. So interview and interrogation training is important, and it's huge. And that was of great value reading people as they're talking to you, you know, little things like that. Because if you can become a good interviewer, you become a good interrogator.
So that training helped become better as a cop?
Oh, as a detective, an investigator, sure. Without a doubt.
Often when we see things unfold in the media or on traffic stops, and whether it's good or bad or somewhere in the middle, for us as instructors at a training company, we sometimes get a little uneasy, but we also know there's a resolve to this could have been different. If there had been some thoughtful training put in place, this could have been different. Often there are police organizations that are considering checking a box being quality training enough to say they did something. Do you think that kind of stuff is actually solving an issue, or where should we be looking for progressive police training? And again, maybe this is at my, to kind of emphasize what my life purpose is for law enforcement. I've learned that, my God, we can share what we know as better cops and make cops better. You know what I mean? So that's why I'm asking, where do you think we're at what as far as what they're considering good training versus actually what is good training?
I think, and by the way, we were a certified regional training center, the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. There were three of them in was throughout the state of Wisconsin. We had one, the city of Milwaukee Police had one, and there's the technical college. The community college has a third. We're certified by the state to train officers. And we trained officers from other agencies as well. But I think we missed the boat a little bit on training, because that's only one aspect, the training aspect. You don't get good at something just because you train. You get good at it through repetition. And so we train, but then we're like, you know, for in service, right? Which, you know, recertification, in service. We train, you know, go for a day or two, whatever. And then it's like, okay, you're done for 6 months. Well, you're not going to become proficient unless you practice it. Practice, 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 as they like to say. Mm-hmm. The example I like to use, Tiger Woods, arguably the best golfer in the history of the game. Arguably, okay. Some people might have others, you know, Ben Hogan, Jack Nicklaus. That's fine. I said argue. We can have the argument. However, Tiger Woods was as good as he was, as good as he is, because he went out and hit 5,000 golf balls a day. 5,000 golf balls. Practice, practice, practice. That's why he was the best. Nobody else had the will or the interest on the tour to hit 5,000 golf balls a day. But that is why everything became second nature to him. When he needed to hit a shot, he would. Not because he was trained, but because he practiced. And so I like to use that with law enforcement officers. I don't know how to do this, but we don't give them a chance to practice continually. We train them and then we send them out into the field. And then we look at their work, and, you know, sometimes they'll do some stuff and you're kind of a head scratcher, right? And what I tried not to do as a supervisor is I tried not to second guess my people's decisions. I questioned them and I asked them about it. And I would do this to my upper command staff too when they had to make decisions, because I encourage them to make decisions. Don't come running to me with all this stuff. Make the decision. You get paid the big bucks. You have all the insignia and all that on your uniform. Use it. Use your head. I promoted most of the people in my agency by the time I was done. And I promoted them because I thought they had the ability. And I wanted them to trust their own judgment and believe in themselves. And if a decision was made, the same with a person on the street, a cop, and you looked, you know, I just asked, walk me through it. Walk me through your decision-making, because that's what we're talking about here, decision-making. We don't emphasize that either in our training. You know, decision-making, human nature, behavioral sciences, so that you can understand human behavior. And they would, if they could walk me through it, I could see, well, they thought this out. It just didn't turn out the way that, you know, they hoped. Because sometimes it is that, it's hope. Well, I'm going to try this, or I'm going to do this. And nothing's certain about a law enforcement officer's world. So you try things, different things. And as long as it appeared to me that they thought this thing through, maybe it's not the decision I would have made. But I said, you have to make the decision that I would have made. It wasn't my decision to make. It was your decision. It sounds like you thought it through. All right. You know, use that as a learning experience and, you know, try to affect a better outcome next time. That's how I handled it. Not you should have, and you were trained to. You know, the training becomes too static at times. And then when you get into these situations where there's adrenaline and there's chaos and confusion all around, we don't train in those. We sit in a classroom, for heaven's sakes, right? But then, you know, the real world presents different variables around what you're trying to do. You're trying to maintain crowd control and this and that, and you're worried about officer safety. And so we forget sometimes that it's not really all about training. Make sure when you're hiring people, you're putting them through those exercises that can pinpoint, hey, this guy, this girl uses good judgment. They have good judgment skills. We can teach them some of the other things, but they can think and they're not afraid to think. And I think that would serve officers better in terms of the training is we got to let them, we got to make sure they can practice this stuff. And I don't know how to do that. I mean, you can't, they got to go out on the street, right? And apply what we gave them. But you hope over time, and that's what experience is, you get better over time because you've seen these things before. Sometimes you see some new stuff you haven't seen, but for the most part, you don't. It's stuff you've seen before. And through experience, you become better at it. That's the practice. That's the hitting 5,000 golf balls. You don't have to think about it anymore. And that's that, I don't know, I guess that's a sweet spot that we need to try to find. I don't have the answer to that. That's stuff that you guys got to find. That sweet spot between training and then allowing these people through the application of it over and over and over and over again to get better at it.
What I hear you saying when you say allowing these people is having good administrative support to understand that if you're giving them the tools and expect them to do a job, when they do it, whether good or bad, you must be there to support them.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. Like I said, they may have made a different decision than you would, but it wasn't your decision. I was reminding myself, well, it wasn't my decision. You know, I gave that authority to them and they used it. Yeah, sound pretty sound to me. I might have done something different, but who cares? You know, good for you. That instills confidence in them the next time. Instead of the, well, you should have done this, could have done this better. You can always do better. But what, you know, instead of asking, how can we do this better from a particular situation? Maybe we should just ask, you know, will this person be able to learn from this thing and go on and do great things, reach their potential? And that's a hard thing to do. I don't envy you with what you guys are doing. But, and I, you know, I was, like I said, we had the regional training center, but I wasn't in training. I was the sheriff. But I always talk to my trainers about this stuff. I go, why do we do some of these things? Like I was on the firing range. We're talking about technical skills now. And we're doing certain firing exercises that you'd never do on the street. And so when I'm down there, because I had to be certified too, so I had to go once, twice a year, whatever, to qualify. And I would ask my trainers, I go, when would I be standing 50 feet away behind something and be firing at somebody? You know, it's just, that's not cops. It's usually in close contact, right? A guy pulls a gun and he's in close contact. And we're doing all these things. Now, we didn't set that up. The state mandates it. He's got to be able to hit this many shots from 30 feet away. But that's not what real life on the street is. So I would challenge my trainers, you know, challenge the state and say, this stuff is stupid. This stuff's not working. It's not real life for cops. The cops are telling us, hey, here's what would help me on the street, blah, 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 blah. And we got to listen to them too and push back a little bit on the state.
A lot of the things we do is why I'm motivated to continue to show up and run a large police training company to try to address the moot gestures. And Sheriff, I went to 3 police academies about 4.5 years because I jumped around frequently. And some of them are very significantly difficult. But I remember leaving police academies. Like, here we are again. I know nothing in 6 months. I can tell you, if you want to give me a test on the nomenclature of a handcuff, yeah, which I'll never testify to in court, I can tell you with the ratchet, the pin, the locking mechanism. Why did I spend 5 hours today on learning about what a handcuff and how it's made and the different kinds of cuffs and double locking and hinged? And, you know, I remember graduating the police academy, my third one here in New Jersey, and it was a very strict academy, very difficult. We looked like the Marine Corps drill team on the stage. I mean, we practiced for this 5-minute ceremony for about 4 months. From, you know, we were just practicing, drill, instruction, drill, parade, march. I remember being on the stage going, what do you do when a car smells like weed? How are we here 6 months? And not one person told us that. And on top of it, which is crazy, now I'm watching cops like, oh, if the car smells like weed, I guess you could search it. Where can we search? How far can we search? What can we do with the people? Nobody even told us at our police agencies that we didn't have the automobile exception at that time. You had to get a search warrant. So we're out there doing the work, and then we're seeing a judge, and he's like, why are you guys searching cars? We're like, we watched cops, you know, so, you know, here we are 2-3 years in the job, and the internet wasn't as prevalent as it is today. There wasn't a company like ours that is what I believe in my heart, helping a lot of people understand what you can and can't do. We weren't intentionally doing things wrong. We're having evidence suppressed. Internal affairs is like, because they have to open an IA in New Jersey when you have something suppressed. They're like, what were you thinking? I'm like, what were you thinking? Last training I had, I stood in a room for 30 minutes and push down on a doll that clicks trying to get a rubber meatball out of its throat. This is what you guys have set me up for, right? Like, I mean, what are we talking about here? And that was my real rub with look, I love cops. I think they're the best people I've ever met in my life. They're just so good. It makes my life so easy to be in this organization. And I just feel like they've gotten such a raw friggin' deal that if I know I can help to do something for them, what a shame. A shame on me for ever not opening my mouth. And I'm subject to a lot of criticism. You may hear things about me some point in your path that I just don't understand why people can't conceptualize what our intentions are. It's to put bad people in jail and make sure cops go home at night safely to their families. And then follow the Constitution, follow the rules. Just follow the rules. Here's what you can and can't do. You know, you can go into that house with that. You can go in. Did you know you can go into that house with that? Yeah, well, I didn't know that. But you can't do that once you're in the house. You just got to go and do that, and then you have to leave the house. But once you're in there, if you happen to see someone in plain view, that actually works. And, you know, people haven't heard this 25, 30 years of the career, and they're like, these guys are crazy. You can't do shit like that. No, you actually can, but nobody's ever talked about it. It's written here in the law of what you're allowed to do. Anyway, that's my mini rant, Sheriff. That was me trying to express to you that but men and women like you and I are cut from the same cloth and really are putting ourselves out there to try to implement change and make this just better when we're gone. So they could look back and say, you know what? Sheriff David Clark had the spine to stand up and say what he believed in. And while it rubs some people the wrong way, well, it may have reduced opportunity for him. It meant a lot to a lot of people to show up and do what he did. And it takes a real load of courage to do that. I know I'm living it. I watch it. I know what you're going through. I know what you go through at times. I know how uncomfortable it can be and how sometimes the good feels like it's outweighed by the bad. But, you know, I just want to take a moment to say, like, it's important the work that you're doing. If people don't tell you that enough and you feel like you're subject to criticism, know that people like me appreciate somebody like you, because there's, for every one guy like you, there's 4 that aren't like you. And we need more guys like you.
Some people are glad that they're 4 not like me, I say facetiously. But yeah, I, you know, just with what you said there, we come back full circle on some of this stuff. We gotta get people to think, challenge them to think, challenge them in their thinking skills, for heaven's sakes, and then have them articulate it after. That's what I would do. Walk me through it, and you know. My dad used to say it a lot, you know, as a kid growing up, think, you know, like do something stupid, you know, kid, it's age appropriate, stupid stuff. Right. You know, my dad would ask me about it. And I, you know, what'd you do that for? You know, well, I don't know. Think, you know, think, damn it. And I think that's important. And too many of these cops are afraid now. And you know what? This environment, this anti-cop environment did it. They're afraid to use their judgment now. They don't trust their judgment. And it's having devastating effects, I think, not only for officer safety, but for the community at large. Mm-hmm. They don't trust it anymore. And I don't know how to get that back, but that's one of the byproducts, I think, of this war on cops. Cops are like, not worth it. I'll just do as I'm told. I'll do it by the book. And that's not what we need. We need problem solvers. We need people that understand human behavior and, you know, put people in position to succeed and, you know, deal with the fallout from it. Sometimes, like I said, horrible things go wrong, but not through the cops' fault. And, you know, we look and we say, hey, you know, okay, yeah, this, we were hoping for a better outcome, but we didn't get it this time. But we'll get it next time.
I'm holding on to the thought that not all hope is lost. And we see that through our programs, that some real amazing things continue to happen. And to try to not have a jaded view on all is lost. And I will spend the remainder of my life committed to law enforcement to try to shift things back. And I got to tell you, there is some progress. There's always pushback. But we do have progress. And if I didn't think there was progress, I would probably lay my sword down, but I'm on my steed charging forward. And there is some detriment to being on this kind of mission in the world that we live in. There's no question about it. And I know that you know what it feels like. So, Sheriff, where can people find you? I know you're on Instagram because I follow you, but where else can they find you? And what do you, I know you wrote a bunch of books. Give it to them.
Well, one book, Cop Under Fire, beyond the subtitle is Beyond Hashtags of Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America. You can find me. I'm most active on Twitter, and it's at Sheriff Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E. Don't forget the E. That's where I do most of my work. I do some Instagram, but the good stuff's on Twitter. The juicy stuff's on Twitter. And Instagram, same handle, at Sheriff Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E. Parler, with a Telegram, it's all at Sheriff Clark. Facebook, it's at Sheriff Clark. And then also, I started a nonprofit, a political conservative grassroots organizing nonprofit called Rise Up Wisconsin. People can go to riseupwisconsin.com, the website. I put out a newsletter. I talk about a lot of these issues that we talked about today. And also, you can find me. I write a column twice a month at Blue Magazine. I do a bi twice a month. And I talk about a lot of these issues, too, as it relates to crime, race, politics, law enforcement, that sort of thing. So I'm still very active. I'm also a contributor on Newsmax TV. That's where you'll find me now. I know people say, hey, we miss you not being on Fox. I got hired by Newsmax to be a contributor. So you can catch me on Newsmax TV as well, talking about these same issues.
I know you hear thank you a lot, but I'm going to thank you with this following thing is keep showing up. Because we need you and we appreciate you. So every time that it gets a little difficult, if you could hear this, is that don't forget about the 50% of people that actually love you. You know, if we're doing 50-50s like you used earlier, if we always see the 50% of the bad. We have a hard time sometimes seeing the 50% of the good. And yeah. I've learned a lot of that in life. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this today. And it reaches the ears of several hundred thousand police officers or first responders in some sense, to be reinvigorated that there's somebody like you out there who is not afraid and has a spine and setting an example of what it means to adamantly hold your position for the right and better of the United States of America.
Well, thanks. I owe it to the men and women, like I said, who still have to go out there and protect and serve. You know, I was putting people in harm's way. Whenever you send a law enforcement officer out as a boss and chief executive, a supervisor, you're sending people out in harm's way, not knowing if they're going to come back. There's no guarantee. Most times they do come back, but they don't always come back. And the least I can do now is take my 40 years of experience and give it back. It doesn't do me any good to walk out of the profession with all of this experience and my opinion on things. Not the smartest guy. I'm not suggesting I don't need to be, but I have a lot of experiences that others don't have. I just want to share those with people, and that's how I give back. And then support. I get to, like I said, talk about some of these instances. When the cops are right, I'm front and center defending. And when they're wrong, I say they're wrong too, but you know what? More times than not, they're right. So that's a good thing.
You are a true patriot, and I can't thank you enough for being here today. So it's great meeting
you. My pleasure.